Maybe I should provide a little history.
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
I know.
All right.
I don't have 903.
On the chair.
Oh. That happened. Now I feel like I'm in the wrong place.
House Committee on Revenue for May 7th, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, we have a long agenda today. I've scheduled a meeting to run till 4. Hopefully, we won't need it. So we're going to get going. I want to turn to the back of the agenda and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 903, since we have an august member of the lower house with us today to testify on that. You know it's the lower house because that's where the water ran when the fire in the governor's office occurred. It did not run toward the house. It ran toward the Senate. So we know it's the lower house.
Yes.
And, but comments will be germane to the bill from now on.
This is quite germane.
David, would you like to present the bill for us? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So Senate Bill 903 repeals the sunset of the law authorizing school districts to impose local construction taxes, by the way. This is the authority that was granted to school districts in 2007 session. In the latest school year that data is available for, in year 2012 and 13, school districts were able to mobilize $15.5 million using this construction tax. For your information, we have time series data for local construction taxes raised through the years on all lists. And that's a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you. Senator Devlin, thank you very much for being here. And please consider my earlier remarks to be in jest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Glad to be in front of this august committee with this bill. The particular bill, I'm going to give my prepared remarks, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the history, because I think there may be some need for some history here in this discussion. Again, I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. 8 years ago, key stakeholders got together from the Oregon Home Builders Association and Education to address overcrowding in some school districts, where the overcrowding of classrooms was partially due to additional residential and commercial construction in the district. The solution that both groups agreed to was allowing school districts to be the sole users of the construction excise tax. At the time, only one local government had put in place an excise tax, and that was the City of Canby. It was agreed that allowing school districts the exclusive use of this tool allowed new construction to help provide some funding for school capital construction projects in school districts. Canby and other jurisdictions with an excise tax, and I still believe it was only Canby, was grandfathered in. That bill had a 10-year sunset provision in it. SB 903 simply removes the sunset on this program and allows an existing excise tax on construction to be used only for capital construction projects for school districts that have the excise tax or pass an excise tax on construction in the future. Jurisdictions that were grandfathered in prior to the passage of the original bill will continue to have the authority to keep their original construction excise tax in place. Just a little bit in history in this. When I came to the legislature in 1997, I think I spent all the time, every session up until the time that this was enacted, debating SDCs for schools. There were bills every session. There was rancorous debate every session. There was never any agreement on SDCs for schools. If you start to get into the issues, it gets a lot more complex than it appears on the surface. Parties did come in agreement on this mechanism. The mechanism has generated a fair amount of revenue. Of course, there was a period of time in which during the recession it did not generate very much revenue because there was not very much new construction. I think when this was considered in the Senate, I think all the testimony was in favor. No one has come to me in opposition, but like anything in this building that smells of revenue, people have now grabbed onto the bill and thinking that it's a mechanism for creating another source of revenue for another purpose. I would only say to that, this took a lot of time to work out. If you want to work out over the interim a new excise tax for some other purposes, more power to you. But I'm here to actually support this excise tax because I think of it is benefit, particularly to school districts that have significant growth within their territory. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Let me ask the first one.
Yeah.
These other people who are looking for ways of raising revenue, did they appear at the Senate committee that considered this?
Not to my
bill?
Knowledge.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Smith Warner, please?
Thank you. And thank you, Senator Devlin, for being here. It's lovely to see you. I guess I would like to hear your argument as to why we should repeal the sunset instead of perhaps renewing it to give our, and why we should not have the opportunity to kind of check back in on this and see that it is still being used in the way that folks want it to be used on a periodic basis.
Well, I think that I think you should repeal the sunset. Obviously, you are, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith Warner. It's been already a very long day. But obviously, the committee and members are free to review this at any time. But I think it's actually important to remove the sunset here because if you don't remove the sunset, the program will, in my understanding, go away. I think one of the other issues you get into in a construction excise tax is that you know, the rates on this were negotiated, and there's actually a certain level at which you would let me, how I'm searching for a way to say this. It might become very difficult to pass a measure in this building. I'll put it just bluntly. I often talk about a constitutional problem in this building, and it usually has to do with 1631 or 36 and 18. And the reality is there's agreement between parties on this. There's agreement to go forward. It does generate money for schools. There's a point at which I think you would not have that agreement in this building on an excise tax if you were to try to raise it for other purposes. Obviously, jurisdictions, local governments impose also, you know, many, many systems development charges for the services that they provide. But those charges plus this are their existing costs for new development, both residential and commercial. And there's only so much you can add to the cost of new development before you start to impede the ability to have new construction. And if you're concerned about the affordability of housing, there's only so much you can add to the cost of producing housing before it starts to seriously impact the cost of that housing.
Okay.
That's a long answer. My apologies for that.
Other questions for someone over here, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Senator, very much. And this may be a question for staff, but just to clarify, are the taxes in question here considered property taxes subject to the limitations, or are these, this is a tax on construction activity outside those limitations?
So it's excise tax, not property tax.
Thank you.
And the dollars are used for school construction?
Mm-hmm. Only for capital projects.
Capital projects.
Mr. Chairman, if I could leave you with one not so serious comment. The reason obviously water flows towards the Senate, which is lower, I think you should understand one of the things that is related to that. That means that that portion of the building is more stable because it has sunk farther into the ground. That means in the case of an earthquake, the Senate is a little bit more protected than the House.
Thank you for that insight, Senator. And with that, we'll move on to our list and excuse you if you would like to be excused.
Thank you.
Scott Berry, Laurie Wimmer, and something Allen.
Morgan Allen.
Morgan now.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders today. I can't stress enough the importance of the negotiations and the agreement after years and years of kind of battling over these issues with the school folks, that we finally came to an agreement, and it was probably a group of maybe 20, 30 people in a room over a very long period of time, I would say, at least 6-8 months, working out the particulars of this construction excise tax for schools, and at a time when the cities who had access to the excise tax for 20, 30, 40 years were not using it in any way, shape, or form. And so it seemed like at the time, and I still think today, the right vehicle and the right way to allow construction in areas where there's a lot of construction, and especially in times when the economy is good and the housing and commercial construction is booming, to help offset that with a direct relationship with the capital construction for schools, which is needed.
And to make it clear, though, the home builders support this bill.
Absolutely. Home builders are in full support of the bill, and again, I think worked at the time with Senator Ryan Deckert to craft it, along with the schools and any number of other groups that were involved, but it was a large group.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. And we were part of a coalition that has worked for several sessions to innovate policy solutions to school district facilities and construction needs. And this was one piece of a five-bill package that passed in 2007 and subsequently that was designed to meet this goal. Though the 2008 housing crash put a speed bump on our pathway of seeing this as the racehorse we hope it to be sometime, we believe that Oregon's improved economy will enable us to boost the financial success of the CET program in the future, and that's why we are here in support of Senate Bill 903, which I'd point out passed on the Senate floor by a 26-vote support margin to end the sunset of the local preemption, and which we support in order to protect the viability of this important tool. We urge your support for this bill, and happy to answer any questions if you should have them.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Morgan Allen on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association in support of Senate Bill 903. As has been mentioned, this was part of a bipartisan compromise package in 2007. And I think most of you are very aware that we have some serious facility needs in our state. We're rapidly getting to the place where we have and have-not districts. We have a lot of districts that have gone out repeatedly unsuccessfully for bonds, and this is really the only other tool in the toolbox to address deferred maintenance and facility needs for many of our communities. 56 school districts are now utilizing the construction excise tax. The most recent data brought in about $15 million a year to help those school districts, and that's a couple years old. That's really before the housing market picked back up and construction picked back up, so we expect to see those numbers tick up in the future. And as was mentioned before, cities and other local governments really weren't utilizing this tax. It was seen as a vehicle that was reasonable to give the authority to schools. We don't have the luxury of having systems development charges, urban renewal, and other things at our disposal to deal with our facilities and property needs. So, again, it passed the Senate 26-4, and we're very comfortable keeping the exclusivity for schools to use this construction excise tax, and we urge your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was here in 2007, but I don't remember all the details, so I had two questions that I probably knew at one time. Can you help me translate? I'm looking at the chart that has the districts that are using it and the revenue that they've created. Can you give me any sort of sense of how, as I recall, there's a maximum rate. Mm-hmm. Are the school districts that are doing it, are they all at the maximum rate? Is there a range of that? Mm-hmm. And can you give us a sense of, you said 56, What's been the discussion like that has led to that, and are there school districts who have decided not to do it? What can you share about all that, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Reed, this is, I believe, on OLIS as well, but there's some information from the Department of Revenue. When the tax started, it could be $1 per square foot, and it's been indexed over the years, and I'm looking at the most recent numbers. It's now you can charge $1.17 per foot, and then there's some maximum for non-residential for like big box stores or other things. Right. I believe that's right around $30,000 right now. Does that sound about right, Scott? Somewhere in that neighborhood. $29,200 is actually right in front of me. It's something that I think a lot of school districts are considering but really hadn't because of the recession. I mean, this passed in 07, sure. You know, and as you look at the numbers, you can see many of the districts have really come online in the last couple of years. We think more districts are going to explore this as an option as the housing picks back up. I don't know, the Representative Reed, your question about whether they're charging the full maximum $1.17 per square foot. I would assume and presume that they are. I could check with the Department of Revenue or some of the districts and see, but I would assume many of them are probably charging the rate.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment. That would be helpful for me to know if there's anybody that's doing something less than. I'm just curious about whether people are graduating into it or if they're going right to the maximum, how that works.
We can work with committee staff and see if Department of Revenue has any of that data.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Thank
and
you,
then
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Smith-Warren.
I think I can add some context to the discussion because I'm on a school board, and we did adopt this, I'm going to say right about in 2008, at the high point of the building boom, lots of development going on around Hood River. But
that's what it says here, yeah, 2008.
But we had a very thorough discussion as a board about, you know, what would this, not wanting to drive up costs for construction, certainly as a home builder, I understand that, $1 per foot adds up. But at the end of the day, we ended up with $1, but we could have chosen less. But we did choose to go for $1 at that point in time. However, on a recent agenda item that we had on our board schedule, we haven't communicated with our county does the collecting, okay, for the fees when folks come in for the building permit. They hadn't got the news about the indexed rates. So even though we could have had this at $1.17, it still is at $1 in Hood River County. So we're having that discussion now about, do we want to keep it as it is, or do we want to increase it? You know, my point would be, it's really kind of a luxury. It's not something we live by, and I would rather have folks liking our school district instead of looking at us like you're trying to get every penny out of there, because we still have a local option levy we have, and obviously property taxes too. So there is permissivity built into the statute, I believe. But just as an example of how we've used it, it's not the kind of thing you're going to build a new school with. It doesn't generate that kind of money. No. But it does help to supplant your maintenance budget. And for this next year, in fact, we're using close to $200,000 that we have in our account to pay for a facility survey, because we have a facilities bond that's going to be expiring in a year and a half. And we're paying the folks to come in and do a survey, come up with the plans, tell us what to do, and so forth. So it's money we would not have on our school district budget. We just don't have that kind of money to spend. So it's allowing us to come up with a good plan, which I think will save our taxpayers money long term. So it's been very successful for us. Our community has worked with it very well. So anyway, just a little bit of context.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. That is really useful information. I have two questions about how it's how it's implemented, and also about that indexing. So, when a school district decides to do this, just a vote of the school board,
correct?
And they pass it, it does not have to be referred to the voters, or okay? So the school board votes on it, and then will this continue to be indexed? If we remove the sunset, will it continue to be indexed? It will.
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
Yes.
Because the original language.
Other questions? I have one.
I didn't.
I understand that there's the possibility that another unit of government may come in and ask to be included in this tax. Would that make a difference to the home builders and its support of the bill if that were to occur?
Chair Barnett, members of the committee, it would. Again, this was something that was worked out over quite a long period of time, and I think even for, I don't want to speak for the folks from the school education community, but even for them, when you've got a city collecting, or a county in some cases, local government collects this tax, that's where those commercial and residential permits are pulled. They were part of the discussion when this bill passed, and in fact, I believe there's a administrative fee for the collection of that they negotiated at the time.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Wendy Johnson, Elizabeth Edwards, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today?
Wendy Johnson here today on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. SB 903 is before you today, and I'll just be upfront with you. I've totally missed the bill in the Senate as the newbie. If you look at the bill, it references an Orlaw site and a school number, and I had no idea what it was repealing or anything. Basically, it does repeal an Orlaw site that preempted local government from continuing to have that tax authority. I mean, there wasn't even anything in statute until the 2007 session when this whole set of construction tax provisions were put in, because cities and counties and service districts all had that authority under their home rule to just do this tax. Very few cities and counties were doing that tax, but there were a few. It wasn't just Canby. See, the list I have is that Ashland, Bend, Canby, Cornelius, Depot Bay, Fairview, Jacksonville, Madras, Newburgh, and Rogue River all had some sort of construction tax. It was a pretty limited tax. All of them used it for a specific purpose, except for Cornelius, it was for the general fund. But Bend used it for affordable housing, Ashland for community development engineering, Rogue River used it for street maintenance. So the cities were using this tax, but a pretty limited basis. It was a tool in the toolbox. As you know, cities could implement a sales tax on some items right now. Most of them don't. It's just a tool that a community could use. And so we're here today to ask you to lift that preemption. I have the testimony from back in 2007 where the League vehemently did oppose the preemption. So it was not a compromise agreement. There was opposition for it. Many amendments were suggested to put the same caps on cities if that was needed, but we really had total unfettered discretion until this bill passed in 2007, is my understanding, because it was under our authority. We do support the ability of schools to do this. They did not have that authority. They would have to be granted by the legislature to have the authority. And so that's sort of two parts to the bill in 2007, to provide the authority to schools, but to take away the authority of local government. It's that second part that we would request an amendment to take off that preemption that would be going in perpetuity if you do sunset, take out the sunset altogether. So that's our concern. There, as you saw the list that's provided in OLIS, there are only 56 schools that are using it right now. My understanding is there are about 200 school districts, so many of them have chosen not to, just as the cities have not chosen to in the past. The bill did preempt local government, but it grandfathered in all the districts and school or cities and counties that were using it. So we still have some cities that are still using this tax, and that can be done at the same time as schools. So our position is that they're not mutually exclusive. You could have both of them. But we also, as you heard from testimony yesterday, we know that property taxes are bread and butter. It's our largest source of income for cities. And so we know that we can't have a construction tax that's too much, that we're going to stifle construction. But it is a tool for infrastructure, frankly, just as it is for schools, for capital construction. Some cities do not have the money to pay for that infrastructure, and this was a tool that was at their disposal that now is not. And so it's pretty much the mantra of all of our cities each session, is to take out any preemptions and to try to stop any further preemption. So that's what we're asking today. SDCs has come up a little bit. Those are limited to five areas: the water, wastewater, transportation, parks, and one other. And those have to be used for capital improvements, just as this construction is for school. But it really narrows what you can use. And for a lot of our cities, that whole process is just too expensive, because you have to do a study and testing and all that to even implement the SDC. The tax was much more easy for smaller cities to implement. They could set it at the rate they needed. They could limit it to what their infrastructure needs were. And so it was just a much more flexible tool that now isn't there. Again, I'm sorry to be late to the table since we missed it in the Senate, but would ask you to think carefully about lifting that preemption indefinitely, because it did take away a right that cities did have. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Edwards on behalf of the City of Portland, also joining in Wendy Johnson's apology for coming late to the table on this. We similarly missed it on the Senate side. And I guess I would echo Wendy's comments. Our concern is that the bill will permanently preempt local governments from imposing construction excise taxes, except for those that were grandfathered in. In 2007, the city of Portland didn't have the same wisdom as the city of Canby and a few other cities around the state to have a construction excise tax at that time. But that shouldn't be construed that it would never be a helpful tool that might be used at some point. We support the school district's ability to impose construction excise taxes, but we believe that local government should similarly be able to make that choice to use or not use construction excise taxes. And the use of the tool by one entity certainly, as Wendy pointed out, doesn't preclude the use by another. So with that, I'll just keep my remarks brief. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? I have several, I think. I've gone back to look at the 2007 Oregon Session Laws, Chapter 829, which is referred to in the bill. The bill repeals Section 1. Section 1 appears to limit the right of local governments or local service districts from imposing a tax on the privilege of constructing improvements. And then it indicates what it does not apply to, including taxes on which a public hearing was held before May 1st, 2007. Okay, so I want to make sure I understand. I understood that what this bill did was to remove a sunset on the right of the school districts to impose this construction tax. Is that what it actually does? It doesn't appear, based on what I'm reading now, that that's what it does. It appears to repeal the sunset on the limitation on local governments and local service districts. Help me understand that.
So as far as I understand the language in this bill, it is repealing the taxing, the sunset of the taxing authority by school districts to impose construction taxes. And the taxing authority is set to sunset on January 2018, it's removing that sunset. The purpose of this bill is.
All right, so the section we're repealing is Section 1, is the section that says Section 1 of this 2007 Act is repealed on January 2nd, 2018. That's the sunset you refer to. Section 1 of this 2007 Act is repealed on January 2nd, 2018. Now, Section 1, what that means is that according to the original bill, Section 1 would disappear as of January 1 of 2018. What Section 1 does is limit the right of local governments and local service districts from imposing a construction tax. Mm-hmm. Now, other people are looking at this. Misread this?
Yeah.
Chair
Barnhart, members of the committee, it is circular, but my understanding is all the bill does is delete Section 9 from the OR laws, which that section is the one that would have made the main part of the bill go away.
I get you. Thank you.
So, yeah.
Thank you. That's an amateur error on my part. You're quite right. So it removes the section that says Section 1 goes away.
Correct.
All right. Is there a sunset on the authority of the schools to levy a construction tax? It doesn't appear that there is.
That's the Section 9 that the program was supposed to go away in 2018. That taking away Section 9, which is what this bill.
Section 1 refers to local government,
yes,
or local service district. Is a school district a local service district?
No.
No, it would keep, the bill would just keep Section 1 in place in perpetuity.
No, but the part I'm, the thing I'm asking about is Section 2 says construction taxes may be imposed by a school district in accordance with Sections 2 to 8 of this Act. The bill doesn't affect Section 2. So it appears to me, based on this Act from 2007, that the school district's authority to levy a construction tax is not affected by this bill. What this bill affects is the section that restricts the capacity of local government or local service districts from levying a tax. So I think that that the understanding of the bill, my understanding of the bill, based on what I'm reading here, is quite different from what I think was in the other material we've seen. I think we need a clarification of that.
Chair Brown, I think you're correct that basically this is about making the preemption on local government go
well,
in perpetuity.
I was planning to just go ahead and work the bill today, but I think we'd better get a clarification of what the bill actually does, because it appears to me as though what the bill does is it makes permanent the rule that says local governments and local service districts may not impose a tax.
Right.
That's correct. It doesn't do anything, as far as I can tell, to the authority of a school district to impose a construction tax.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Anything else for this couple? And I apologize for my density here. I had not actually looked at the old Act before just this minute, so I had clearly misunderstood what the bill does. Representative Johnson.
Thank you guys for being here. Again, I was looking on the testimony register from the Senate side, and I didn't see you all there, but you're here. So, but cities have, to my knowledge, a multitude of ways to raise revenue for a variety of purposes, correct?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I don't know all of the tools, but I'm aware of a few of the e-zones, the urban renewal, and property tax.
A big one, isn't it?
But the problem is in smaller towns or smaller cities, that's not a realistic tool, neither one of the urban renewal or the e-zone or any of those. It's property tax, and as you know, because of Measure 5 and 50, those are pretty limited. So this is a tool that some of our smaller cities or towns would like to have at their disposal, but they don't have it.
I guess the point I'd like to get on the record is that cities continue to have a variety of tools available. School districts are incredibly limited. You have basically about two. So I think on behalf of school districts, I'd kind of like to tell the big guys on the block maybe to leave us alone. Let us have what we have, because these are vital ways for us to raise small amounts of money that can really help to subsidize in the absence of other sustainable funding and so forth. So appreciate what you're doing, but this is a vital tool for us, and we don't want to have to be in a competitive situation, obviously, as a school district and a city or and another taxing entity.
Yeah.
That creates real issues in communities also, as you, I'm sure, we can sympathize with.
Well, thank you, Representative Johnson. I don't have any quarrel with what you've said. But I note that the preliminary staff measure summary on the Senate side said repeals the sunset of the law authorizing school districts to impose local construction taxes. It appears to me that that's not accurate, that doesn't actually state what the bill actually does. I'd like to make certain that we do understand what the bill actually does before we vote on it. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 903, and we've handed staff a little homework to do.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Looks like I have everybody? I do. Great. Let's. What I'd like to do is go through the work sessions that I think we're ready for, what I'd like to do first is open a work session on House Bill 2150, and I would like to hear from the department about the fiscal that has been prepared on this topic.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb, legislative director with the Oregon Department of Education, and with me is Michael Elliott, the state school fund
coordinator.
Mm-hmm. And he has written the fiscal on 2150.
So, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Michael Elliott, state school fund coordinator. 2150 does a lot. It's, as I compare it, I'm not much of a car guy, but as I compare it, you're getting down to the pistons of the engine in determining and in doing the work of 2150. To give you a brief reminder of what it does, is it takes extended ADMW that is currently calculated separately for a charter school from the non-charter schools in the district and combines those numbers. And once it does, instead says, okay, we're going to take all numbers at the district level and then compare the extended ADMWs. Extended ADMW is looking at the ADMW, the average daily membership weighted of a district, the greater of this year or the previous year's numbers. Mm-hmm. And right now we do that for charter schools separately. So if a charter school had 100 weights in the current year but 110 in the previous year, they would get 110 weights. If the non-charters in the district had 900, you know, this year and 800 last year, they would get 900. So you'd add the 110 plus the 900 to get 1,010 weights for the district. That's what they would be paid on. Instead, what 2150 does is takes the 900 and 100, adds those together first to say it's going to be 1,000 and compares it to, I think I was saying 800 and 110 for 910, you would get the 1,000 weights. That's a significant change to the way programming works at the Department of Education. Because the state school fund touches many, many, many other systems, it touches the report card, it touches other assessments, child nutrition is sometimes involved, you have to make sure that the integrity of the system is protected, and so it will require a lot of reprogramming to figure that out again and make sure all the tables are linked, all the data is correct, and that sort of thing. Plus, you're also going to have to change the reports submitted to the school districts and change the spreadsheets used to calculate the state school fund. So it is a very significant impact. In 2011, the legislature passed House Bill 3417, which created this initial change of calculating extended ADMW for charter schools separately, and that took us about 2 years to implement. So it was effective for the 2011-12 school year. We weren't able to fully implement until we were reconciling for that year in May of 2013. So that's why we're looking at a fairly significant fiscal impact for this bill. And I'm happy to answer any questions that people may have.
Could you explain why you didn't tell us this the last time you were here?
In terms of?
The fact that it was going to generate a very significant fiscal. This is a surprise to me today.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, it was my understanding that we had submitted a fiscal previously that included this impact. So you're right, I didn't testify to it, but it was my understanding it was part of the packages and the information we had already submitted to the legislature. So I apologize for not testifying to it and surprising you. That was not my intention.
Is there another way to accomplish the goal that we're trying to accomplish, which is to avoid double counting students in the two situations that we discussed in the earlier hearing, that would simplify your programming and reduce the cost?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I am unaware of a way. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I would have to talk with our information technology individuals, our programmers, our developers, and see if there is another solution. But I was working with them on the original fiscal. And there is another complication. The reason why the fiscal is so high is because we're trying to put a cap on charter school ADMW when a charter school closes or transfers from the district. Currently, there is no cap. That's causing some fluctuations in the state school fund for several million dollars. The cap would say to that charter school only gets 5% of its ADM, average daily membership, added to the district's ADMW for that year. This would eliminate the fluctuations in the state school fund, but again, you're now separately identifying charter schools which come and go, which is a complicating factor for our programming. So again, I'm happy to talk to our IT and individuals, see if there is a better way to do this. I just know that it took a lot of time and effort when this change was made initially.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you, the fiscal that I have on OLIS does not have a number.
Correct.
And says further required. So we don't have a number. We're just being told that it is a significant member?
That was exactly what I was referring to.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
But you don't have a number that's not on this. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Colleagues, my inclination today is to hold this over till Monday and see what the department can do for us in the meantime. If we can avoid sending this to Ways and Means, I think that would be preferred. It is something that we definitely have to get done based on the testimony that we heard last time, because it's a somewhere between $20 and $30 million item in terms of the effect on the school fund. Anybody have a different opinion about the Representative Benz?
No, I don't have a different opinion, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to find out where we would find on OLIS what we just heard. Is there something that summarizes what you just said that we have available in front of us? Because what I'm looking at, I don't see it either. So
there is a fiscal impact of proposed legislation, which is dated May 7th, which says the agency anticipates having a fiscal impact associated with the bill. The amount of the impact is still being determined. A more complete fiscal analysis will be prepared as the measure is considered in Joint Ways and Means. And earlier in the same paragraph is working with the agency to determine the workload and staffing implications of the bill. So we've heard more from the testimony today than was contained in that statement, quite a bit. But until today, it had not occurred to me that this bill had a significant fiscal, and I expected to send it to the floor. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2150, and colleagues, we'll look at this again on Monday and see what you can do in the meantime. Appreciate it. Let's go to House Bill 2126. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2126. Non-residential uses. Kyle, yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So, House Bill 2126. So, just up front, we do have the paperwork for the introduced version. There is a -3 amendment that we're still waiting on the paperwork at this point, or last time I checked. We're hopeful it might come in today, but there's no guarantee we'll have it by the end of the committee. But the -3 amendment would make changes to the bill that would allow, right now the existing exemption allows for special districts. Those, they're identified in ORS 198.010 and 198.180 to opt out, providing the exemption. And the -3 amendment would allow any local taxing district to now have the ability to opt out. I can summarize the bill introduced as well. If you
please, why don't you? Yes.
Okay. So for the bill is introduced. If you remember, this is an existing exemption on the books today. It's a partial property tax exemption, and it's available for vertical housing development. And the two changes in the bill: the first is an extension of the sunset, which is scheduled right now for 1/1/2016, and it would move that to January 1st, 2026. And the second is adding a definition of non-residential use. And we had some testimony on, right now there's not a specific definition for non-residential use, but the testimony that was during the public hearing talked about mixed-use residential, so someone having like a home office or something on those lines, not necessarily fitting within the rules as they are with the statute, with the way it's written. So it's kind of updating that a little bit.
All right. So you're saying we don't have the fiscal?
Not for the -3. No, we don't.
All right. Okay. Well, in that case, we may come back to this, and we'll close House Bill 2126 work session and open a work session on House Bill 2690. And that's also yours, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
So House Bill 2690, so it's a new exemption for property taxation for land that's acquired and held by a nonprofit corporation for the use of developing for low-income housing. So we do have a -1 on this it replaces the content of the bill. It tightens the language a bit. It would require a nonprofit corporation that's within the last 10 years has done this type of work. So they're developing the housing, they're building housing that's then sold for low-income housing. So it tightens it a little on who would qualify. It does at a time period. It's up to 7 years. The land can be held, qualifying for the exemption prior to starting the development, or with an extension of 3 more years, so it can be a total of 10 years that it can be held. We had testimony that once the development begins, so once the nonprofit begins building the home, it does become exempt at that point under ORS 307-130. The original introduced version of the bill was just adjusting 307-130, but with the new language, it does create, rather than be a modification of an existing tax exemption, it's its own separate one at this point. We do have the paperwork on the Dash 1 amendment. It is in there in OLS. You can see the revenue impact. And initially, this would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015. So that'd be this upcoming, this fall, if you will, when the statements would go out. Of course, at this point, we're past the application time where the nonprofit could apply for the property tax exemption without paying a late filing fee to the assessor. And that follows many other statutes where there is a period where a late filing fee of $200.
Thank you.
Or miss on the value. So initially, it's a little bit lower in the revenue impact, assuming any property right. with property tax less than $200 not
Thank
apply.
You. Thank you. We're doing a little jockeying here because what I'd like to the committee to hear is the explanation for the 7 year and extension to 10 years time period during which this could be in effect. I was under the impression when we had the testimony before that we were talking about scattered individual lots that might be any old place, and that 7 year period seemed excessive to me. But now I understand that what actually happens is quite different from that. And I think the committee would benefit from hearing about that.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Shannon Vilhauer, Executive Director with Habitat for Humanity of Oregon. Thank you so much for your careful consideration of this bill. So when I first came to you, we were talking about the period from when the property is first acquired till when we have the active residential permit. And I believe the letter is posted to OLS from Tomlin Harris on behalf of the Oregon County Tax Assessors, who affirms that currently in almost every county in our state, Habitat affiliates are able to hold land tax-free from the time of the permit. It turns out that's not clearly in statute, which freaked us out, is the honest truth, when we got together with some others and heard their concerns. So the recommendation was to just make it really clear that this is an exemption from the time it's applied for until when every home on a given site is built and sold. So of the 75 to 85 homes a year Habitat affiliates, for example, are currently building in Oregon, only about 25 of those are on single-family sites. That's because land is so expensive. So even a very rural affiliate will purchase a property and partition it into 3 lots. If they're building one home every 18 months, that's common if you're in LeGrand, for example. It's really going to take them, but by the time they have their permits and everything and get all the homes built, in the 6 year range. Alternately, our largest affiliate in the state is Portland Metro East. Currently, all of their, unless they're doing an acquisition rehab, every site has between 7 and 32 homes. So to build 30 homes and get all of them sold, they're actually putting in sewers and building roads and sidewalks, as well as every unit and getting it sold on the site. That's the reason for the longer time frame. And I'm sorry if there was some confusion and that seemed like a surprise number. That certainly wasn't our intention.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes,
Representative Whitsitt.
So you're saying every lot or proposed or potential house has to be built before or during that time
within.
It is exempted, mm-hmm. the entire thing is exempted?
No, actually not. I can answer
okay.
that one because I was thinking the same thought, and actually if you look at the amendment, page 1, line 29, line 21, it says it ends on or at the earlier of, and this one is the date on which the nonprofit corporation has transferred title to the residences on the land. So if you've transferred a title to a residence, then the owner of the residence is going to have to pay the property tax.
Correct. Yes.
So if you have 3 and 2 are built out and 1 isn't, then 2 will pay, and so it's only the vacant one that does not pay. Okay.
Sorry. Thank you. That's a very helpful clarification, and that's correct. And maybe if I could just point out, please, there's a significant clawback provision now. So if the nonprofit doesn't perform within either the 7 years or 10 years, if they've paid for the extension and applied for the extension, they will owe the back taxes on the property plus 16% per year simple interest. So there is a significant clawback now.
A huge incentive to get it done.
Right.
Yeah. Representative Smith Horner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering about the added language about requiring that the developer had indeed sold at least one before. Is that to kind of keep out bad actors?
That is exactly the intention.
Great. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What's your pleasure, Representative Vance?
Is it the dash one we're looking
yeah,
at?
Yeah, it is.
Chair?
Yeah.
Sure, I move the House Bill 2126 dash. Is it the dash one?
Yes.
Dash one amendment. Dash one amendment.
Right. Representative Vance moves removes the dash one amendment to House Bill 2690. Is that the one we're on? 2690?
Yes.
2690.
Mm-hmm.
Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. Representative Vance?
Chair, I move House Bill 2690 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves House Bill 2690 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. We'll ask Representative Gomberg to carry, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2690. Let's open the work session on House Bill 3497. That stays again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3497 increases ESD's minimum grant to $1.165 million per year. And also specifies that the growth rate of this minimum grant mirror the growth rate of ESD revenue share and state school fund distribution. And we need to adopt dash A2 amendment that changes that figure to 1.165 from A version.
Great. Well, we're in a work session. Any discussion on this bill and the topics we're discussing here? Representative Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, can you explain to a simple extent, which means for me, how exactly that the indexing it will work for the?
So the way it works is. Every biennium, we anticipate increasing state school fund distribution. So we combine state school fund that the legislature appropriates and local revenue, which basically property taxes and some other things. So that combines them becomes common pot. So out of that, we have some carve outs off the top. And that becomes the pot that should be distributed between school districts and ESDs. So that common pot actually increases, then ESDs' revenue also increases. So then if ESDs' revenue increases by, say, 5%, then this minimum grant will grow also 5%.
Thank you. I was trying to figure out where the tracking number would come from.
Yes.
Thank you.
Right. And so it's related directly to the size of the fund that goes to ESDs in general?
Yes, Chair.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Any other discussion? We're talking about the dash one, is it? The dash two. Representative Vance?
Excuse me, Chair. Is it the dash two or the dash A2?
It's A2. It is A2.
A2.
Right. And what it does is it reduces the initial amount from $1.36 million to $1.165.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I move the dash A2 amendments to HB 3497.
Thank you. Representative Vance moves the A2 amendment to House Bill 3497. Is there any further discussion? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. May I just ask how long the minimum it has the minimum? Do you know how long the minimum has been where it has been?
Since 2008.
Okay. And if I may, historically, so this is what we're trying to do is get out of the habit of having to go back every few years and raise the minimum, and indeed have it indexed reasonably to the size of the school fund.
That's right.
And before 2008, it was simply apportioned along with all the other ESDs. So some of these rural ESDs were getting very small amounts of money.
Gotcha.
And so what happened in that year was a change that said that the minimum would be $1 million. And, of course, as Ozzie Rose told us last time, that was also the maximum for these five. Because of the size of them.
Right. Okay.
Any other discussion on the dash A2? Any objection to the dash A2? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Batts?
Chair, I move House Bill 3497A as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 3497 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Is there a further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. We'll ask Representative Huffman to carry. And if he doesn't want to, we'll assign someone else, but I think he will. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3497 and open a work session on House Bill 2130. You're back. I should have called him out of order, shouldn't I?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2130, the engrossed version. It's another a bill that makes changes to existing exemptions. In this case, it's two existing property tax exemptions, new housing for low-income rental and the nonprofit low-income rental housing. So the changes in the bill is really about establishing criteria for local governments, it'd be the county or the city, that they can apply additional qualifying criteria, assuming it doesn't conflict with what's already in statutes. They can tighten the rules a bit on it, but they still have to be within the bounds of what's laid out in statute. We do have the fiscal and the revenue. There's no fiscal and there's no direct revenue impact. In the testimony, we heard that by allowing counties and cities to have a little bit of more ability to, I guess, impose some of their own restrictions, there may be more use of this, but that would be up to the counties or the cities.
Okay. There's no amendment to this one today, is there?
No, we don't have any.
We have the A engrossed that came from the first committee. Any discussion on this one? Simply adds the right of the locals to add a sideboard that we hadn't thought of. Representative Vance?
Chair, moves House Bill 2130A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves House Bill 2130A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Who would like to carry this bill? This one doesn't have an individual sponsor. If no one yells, I will carry it. All right, Barnhart carries. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2130. Colleagues, Representative Reed, 2691 isn't ready to work today, is it?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So we'll skip
2961.
I knew what you meant, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you do what I meant. 2961, we're not going to work today. We will reschedule that for a later time. Have we heard back on 2150? I'm sorry, 2126, do we have the fiscal now? Hasn't come in. So with that case, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2747.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2747 today has an A2 amendment, and that's an OLIS. And the amendment would The bill overall increases the limitation on subtraction for contribution to College Savings Network account to be an amount per designated beneficiary. Previously, it was a there was a limit on the amount per return that could be claimed. And the bill would prohibit reduction of the state share of the Oregon Opportunity Grant based on amounts available from the College Savings Network account. And it establishes, in the A2 amendment, there is a refundable credit that can be claimed at $150. And it would limit the eligibility to claim the credit to those with an adjusted gross income of less than $50,000 a year if filing a joint return, and $25,000 a year if filing as a single or married filing separately return. I did a revenue impact statement on this. For 2015-17, the impact to the general fund is negative $2.33 million and goes to negative $3.73 and negative $4.29 by 2019-21.
Okay. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. This bill has had an interesting path in history as it's gotten to us. We passed it from the House Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development Committee, where Representative Johnson is also a member. And as Christine said, it attempts to do three things. The form in which it sits before you is a little bit different than we started, but the intent is still clear. And those three things really have to do with making the 529 College Savings Plan more accessible and even more effective. I'm happy to be joined by Michael Parker, the Executive Director of the network, who will have more to say about that. And I think some really interesting study results that underscore the very positive impact that the College Savings has. Just to reiterate what Christine has already said, the three components of the bill have to do with moving the deduction from per taxpayer to per beneficiary. So that if there are multiple kids involved, they can each have a deduction associated with contributions. The second is the refundable credit that Christine mentioned. It is set at $150 in the A2 amendment, and that's only available to those who have incomes below $25,000 if they are filing as a single person and $50,000 if they're a joint person. That's a large part of the change in our bill. We've had a couple of different revenue impact statements, so we'd certainly like to do more, but I think we're trying very hard to target the lower end of the income spectrum for whom a deduction is simply not useful. Finally, we want to put into statute something that is already the practice, which is that when the in my view, underfunded Oregon Opportunity Grant is considering who is eligible for that program, we want to make sure that they are not considering assets that are in the 529 college savings accounts. So if someone has saved in anticipation of college, they're not then made ineligible for other forms of assistance by their own good planning. Those are the basics of the bill. I urge your support and happy to have Mr. Parker hit what I missed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Network. Representative Reed did a good job of talking about the bill. I just want to mention a couple of things that we see a lot here in Oregon, and actually as we look at other plans around the country. There's a big push to try to make sure that college savings plans are meeting the needs of everyone, not just those folks who have the dollars that they can actually put in, but those folks who may be lower income folks but still are going to be needing a college education or some sort of higher education training after high school. So the $150 credit really speaks to this, and I was going to share some research that we found recently from the Corporation of Enterprise Development that shows the power of a college savings account even at very low levels. That study showed that children with college savings accounts have greater expectations. Having a college savings account designated for a beneficiary helps children build positive expectations about college. Their parents are sharing the college savings plan with them. There's an expectation you're going to go to school. Children ages 12 to 18 with a savings account for college had a higher math scores and were twice as likely to expect to go to college than those counterparts without a college savings account. So again, even $150 makes a big difference. And lastly, children with college savings accounts do better academically. A couple of points there. Lower and moderate income children with $500 or less in a savings account were three times more likely to enroll in college and actually four times more likely to graduate. So again, we talk a lot about, you know, we got to have thousands of dollars in these accounts over time. But again, just having the account in that child's name really, really makes a big difference. And the last point I wanted to make is children whose parents have saved for their college expenses were less likely to take out higher dollar loans for their college education, putting the children at lower risk for dropping out of college or accumulating burdensome debt. That's kind of an obvious point, but again, I think worth mentioning because a lot of parents at the end of the day, they get to, their kids get to be 15, 16, 17, they don't have a lot saved, and the debt becomes really the only medium that they can to save for college. So we're here at the College Savings Plan really trying to make sure that we get this program to all four corners of the state and to all income levels around Oregon. And this bill, I think, would go a long way to helping families just understand what it's going to take to get their kids in and through school, and also making sure that maybe we get these kids to understand that a college education really is what they should strive to do. And then with that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here and testifying about this. As someone, I've got two kids and two 529 Oregon College Savings Accounts. So I like the simplicity idea of there just being an amount for each kid that is tax deductible. Is that, am I kind of reading that right?
That's correct, Representative.
Okay,
yes.
Great. So, for example, if I had four kids, I would like this even more because then I could have that chunk of an amount for each of those four kids, right?
Representative, that's correct.
Great. Thank you. Follow up? Or
please, yes.
I just asked my three questions. As far as the making it so that it doesn't impact the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I wondered, right now, do 529s count when they're determining FAFSAs at the federal level, the federal form that you fill out for financial aid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, the answer to that is yes. A 529 is an asset to you. The good news there is that it's an asset of the parent, not the child. So when they do the calculation for the FAFSA, the calculation is much smaller, about 5.5%. Otherwise, it'd be about 20% to 50% of the calculation if it was the student's asset.
Oh,
so
great.
there is a small calculation, but again, very small.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And to add to that, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, so we can control the Oregon portion of that. Obviously, we can't do the federal piece, but that's why
exactly.
The Oregon Opportunity Grant is part of that.
Yep, thank you. And that's actually was part of what I was going to follow up with was, would you then be like adding it back in part, if it was part of the FAFSA, would part of this being like kind of adding that back in the same way we do with, you know, state versus federal taxes, would you kind of add that back in when you're figuring out their Oregon Opportunity Grant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moore, happy to be corrected. I think you've got the sequence just slightly backwards. We'd be taking it back out rather than adding it back in.
Right, right. But I mean accounting for that in.
Yes.
Since it's already, because we use the FAFSA as part of determining the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So I guess I'm just checking
right.
on
yep.
making sure that you'd kind of pull it out there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, that it would not get added in the first place. So it would be blind to the Oregon Opportunity Grant when you go for the calculation.
Okay, great. And then my last question, if I may, sir.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as the refundability goes, does that mean this would be like a line on the EZ form that, you know, check here if you contributed to 529 and then that makes you eligible for and I'm not, you don't mm-hmm. really need to show me how the, but I guess I just am always curious of how, because it's easy to do stuff when you're itemizing, but if the point of this is to get to somebody who doesn't itemize, is that generally the way that you do it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, right now when you take your deduction for your college savings plan, it's an other subtraction. Again, not working for the Department of Revenue, I don't know exactly how they will end up doing it, but it would be listed in the actual tax booklet of how you would take it. Right now, I think it's line 18 on the EZ form about other subtractions. But again, not having complete detail, we can check with the DOR and get back.
I think that's right, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith-Warner, I would also just point out the bill says the credit shall be claimed on a form prescribed by the Department of Revenue that contains the information required by the department. So I think what Mr. Parker said is right to be developed.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Johnson.
It's a clarification for the question that Representative Smith Horner is asking about the opportunity grant. There's testimony on OLIS from Bob Brew, the director of OSAC, Oregon Student Assets Commission, who says we do not believe the proposed bill would have any effect on how Oregon opportunity grants are calculated, nor would it require special programming changes to OSAC's award processing system. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's essentially putting into statute what is current practice.
Well, we already heard it.
I see. Thank you, Representative Johnson. That's useful. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. I will note that we don't have anyone else signed up, but we have received testimony from Jody Weiser, Tim Cowan, and I would refer you to our meeting materials and exhibits for that testimony.
And, Mr. Chair, just on that point, I reviewed Ms. Weiser's testimony. She's pretty far off in her description of another bill that we passed at the Higher Education Committee. We're very proud and excited about the approach we've taken with the open education resources concept, but we were nowhere near $5 million, as she says.
I see. Thank you. A useful rebuttal.
There is some comment out here.
Is there someone else who wants to be heard? Please come forward.
Chair and committee members, my name is Tim Cowan. You have my testimony.
We do.
I had that put in. And so, first of all, before I go to the bill, if I can just make a couple general comments on the student loans. In 1990, about two-thirds of higher education costs were borne by the state. Now it's less than one-quarter. Students are asked to pick up the slack, whether in the form of personal savings or student loans. In response to budgetary shortfalls, it's easier to understand higher education than other services because the gap will ultimately be made up by student loans and out-of-state. Well, what's the effect? Students graduating with student loans have decreased or delayed economic activity. This decreased and delayed economic activity calls into question economic forecasts. A decade ago, there was only about $300 billion in such loans outstanding. Now there's $1.1 trillion, based on New York Times. And what I did is a little bit of calculation. If we didn't have the student loans, our national debt would be up 6%. As an example, my daughter has been paying on her student loans over 10 years, and my son over 8 years. So I just wanted to cover that part when we looked at the bill and what we need to be thinking about, because these poor kids and the fact that it has a delayed economic benefit. When I graduated from college, I went and bought a new car the first time I got a job. My son had to delay the purchase of his home for about 5-6 years. So I think, Chair, when I was here, I think this summer, and you received the economic forecasts and so on, I think the model might be a little bit off because they assume that entry into the economy is going to be quicker. Now to the bill. The $4,000 for I'm on Section 1, 2A. $4,000 for a joint return, $2,000 for a taxpayer files other than a joint return. Here's my question. What does a joint return versus a non-joint return have value? If you continue to reduce support for higher education and increase tuition, why do you care about tax credits, and how does it offset the increase? 3A, the cost of living adjustment for the calendar year. Will tuition exceed the cost of living adjustment? Section 2, what constitutes a qualified student? What constitutes a family? How is the contribution by the state defined? And to this date, the state has changed its percentage of its contribution. C, this was very interesting. Manageable debt burden for the student. How do you define manageable? Does the school attended, tuition, degree, expenses, and any other restrictions on work, loans, type of loans, existing loans, savings, and scholarships? what restrictions exist on qualifying taken into consideration. My daughter now pays for her final degree with a Visa card. So she just pays as she goes and pays it off. Five, the amount of family share. Define a family. Does it include an extended family, caregiver of a family member, and share? Be based on the resources of the family, defined resources, assets, debt service, health considerations, both employment, medical expenses, insurances, care of an extended family member, existing loan guarantees, exposure to other loans or expenses, fixed income, credit rating, salary or job stability, contingent liabilities, net worth or negative net worth, credit rating and capital gains. Section 4, 1, household income. First of all, I put in there in big letters, can't be defined. I've said this before. I'm a retired senior vice president and regional manager, Mid-Valley, Central, and Eastern Oregon for First Interstate Bank. The region managed approximately $1 billion in assets. I'll go back to it can't be defined. Two, household income means the aggregate adjusted gross income of all individuals residing with a taxpayer. How does residing with a taxpayer assume that everyone has a financial responsibility for anyone? And then allowed credit. If the taxpayer has a household income of less than $70,000, is household income the same as individuals residing with a taxpayer? So when I went through and read it, I didn't understand anything. And I was sitting there looking at it and going, how does someone look at that and make a decision? Those were some of the comments that maybe you might want to take a look at, because I didn't understand it, and I think we really need to look at just tuition in general and what we can do to help these kids. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from Mr. Cowan? I would simply note that the issue that you raise as a problem is a huge problem. I think most of the members of this committee have been aware of it for a long time. I personally wrote a piece that was published in the Oregon Daily Emerald, the student newspaper at the University of Oregon, I think in 2005, may have been earlier than that, in which I said I'm a grandpa wannabe. And the reason, of course, what it was about, of course, was tuition, loans, and the cost of college. I'm now a grandpa, so I'm no longer a wannabe. But the point, of course, was exactly the point you were making, that we expect our college graduates to establish families, to buy a car, as you pointed out, and a variety of other things. And, of course, most of them with large debts simply can't do those things because of their obligations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Anyone else want to be heard today on House Bill 2747. If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2747. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2266. And I have one other public hearing scheduled, I think, which is Senate Bill 63, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mazin, we're bringing in everybody today, huh?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Feels like I haven't seen you for a while. This is House Bill 2266. It came to you from the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee. And since it has to deal with weight mile tax, they thought that you probably need to see that, since it's one of your favorite forms of taxation. Weight mile tax exemption for dealers and vehicles that are being licensed or have a dealer license on them. That is what the bill is attempting to do at this point.
Thank you. Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty King. I'm the president of Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. And I have a number of big truck dealers as my members. You know, I got a check a couple weeks ago from a company for $2. And I'm going, why did they send me a check for $2? It probably cost them 10 or 15 to make it. And then they sent it back to them because it was for something wrong anyway. But every time a dealer takes a big truck tractor out on the road, he's supposed to pay weight mile tax on it, even though it's only for test drive. It's just up the road and back. And he's trying to sell it. It's never loaded. It's never in operation for that stuff. To pay the 30 cents in weight mile tax on this deal, it's going to cost him 10 or 15, 20 bucks in payroll to get that check written, to follow it through the system, to get it cashed, bring it back, deal with it at the end of the year, year and all that kind of stuff. And then, quite frankly, I mean, it doesn't show it on the fiscals or anything. The state's got to take the 30 cents in. How much does it cost to take 30 cents in to the state of Oregon? A lot more than 30 cents. So I think even though the fiscals and everything show limited and nothing, I think there is fiscal here. I know that there's a great fiscal for the small dealers and even the medium and big dealers for trying to track this thing that doesn't need to be tracked. We're not trying to let them drive from Hermiston to Portland free, okay? Just the test drive, and they got to have the dealer plate on it, and it's got to not have any product in the truck. I think this is a no-brainer, but I don't know of any opposition.
Very good. Questions for Mr. King? Thank you. Does the department want to be heard? You want to put that on the record?
Is that a question? She shook her.
Exactly.
Vigorously said no.
I want to wait to see what she says.
Right.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. The department has no problem with this bill.
That's what we were wondering about. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate that. With that, anyone else want to be heard on this bill? With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2266. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 63. And I assume that's the staff.
That'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 63 is the reconnect bill, the perennial reconnect bill, in which the Oregon statutes are updated to connect to the Internal Revenue Code. The measure updates the connection to the IRC and to other provisions in federal tax law from December 31st, 2013 to December 31st, 2014. There are references in the governing statutes of the PERS program that there's a connection to federal law that establishes taxable income, affects annual benefits payable to members, specifies rules around minimum distribution requirements under certain circumstances. And this measure also updates the connection to federal code that defines shareholders and S-corporations who may represent their companies in proceedings before the tax court magistrate or the Department of Revenue. The measure updates the connection to the Internal Revenue Code to define which organizations may qualify for consideration for a charitable tax checkoff. It updates statutes governing the Oregon College Savings Plan, individual development accounts, and unemployment insurance to connect to the latest version of the IRC as of December 31st, 2014. And it specifies that if a refund is due a taxpayer for a tax year beginning before January 1st, 2015, due to any retroactive treatment from these federal tax law connection changes, then the refund will be paid without interest and cancels the interest or penalties from any deficiencies caused by the reconnect. The measure has a minimal revenue impact, and the statement is there in OLIS, and it's found to have no fiscal impact. There is also an outline there in OLIS from the Oregon Society of CPAs that is a green covered document called An Analysis of Changes in Federal Tax Law for the Year 2014. You'll see that
Oregon statute is automatically connected to a lot of provisions of tax law, and so the changes in federal tax law do affect the revenue of the state. However, this measure only has a very small revenue impact because there are some technical changes there in Section C of that document that have a small impact on revenue, but these are the ones that it was necessary to actually update the statute to incorporate.
Very good. So we'll hear from Mr. Douglas. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. LRO has done a great job of outlining what this bill is about, and you've heard all this before because, as you remember, early in the session, the CPA tax team was here to present the very document that is on OLIS and was just referenced by staff. We are here today to be loving, caring, and supportive of Senate Bill 63.
And I assume to reduce the workload of your members.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Douglas. Representative Bent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering how much additional work we could create by changing a few words here and there so it doesn't fit all of the computer programs that you guys have so carefully designed. We've been through this before, so I'm just asking the question as
Mr.
For no
Chair,
good reason at all,
Representative
really.
Bentz, the chair and I have had this discussion on multiple occasions. It would create work. That might be true, but that is not the kind of work that professionals are interested in doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I certainly agree with that statement.
Yes.
Anything else? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 63? I guess not. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 63. Colleagues, we're going to work this bill later, not today. And I would I've been told by staff that we will not be receiving the fiscal on dash 3 for House Bill 2126. Paul, should I set that over till Tuesday? Does that get it to us by then? All right, so we'll set over the work session on House Bill 2126 to Tuesday next week. We've already set over the work session on House Bill 2150 to Monday. Does that deal with all of the announcements I need to make? I think it does. Next time we see each other, at least in this context, is Monday at 1. Anything else? Have a great weekend. Thank you. Committee is adjourned. Thank you.